Okay, I think we're ready. I want to welcome you again to our plenary luncheon session, and I'd like to introduce our speaker, Phil McLemore. Phil is currently working as a hospice chaplain and a meditation instructor, and that's kind of where he is now. He started out life a little bit differently. He converted to the LDS Church while he was in college, and then went on a mission to Brazil. So all you Portuguese, Brazilian speakers, you can test if he knows any language still. Then he joined, he got into CES, he was an instructor there, and became a chaplain after a little while, as, you know, institute director, that kind of fun stuff. But he was a chaplain for about 20 years with the Air Force. More recently, some of you may have seen his cover article in the April 2006 Sunstone titled Mormon Mantras, A Journey of Spiritual Transformation. He right now lives in West Point, Utah with his lovely wife, Kim. They have four children, and he says they all have families of their own, so I'm assuming that means he's a granddad. But, yeah, I see a chair from the back. So here he comes, and he will grace us with his talk about the garden and on the cross.
Okay, well, welcome, good morning, good afternoon, and what else do you say when you get up? I can't remember. I'm partially blind, so I'll switch glasses here, and if you see me squinting, I'm just not getting things in the right range. If I deliver what I've prepared, it might be some of the most personal sharing that I've done in public. And although I'll be talking about myself, since this is my point of reference, what I'm talking about today is really about you. And I really want you to feel the concepts. Unfolding within you. Certainly I'm not looking for agreement, that's not my objective, but clarity is. And so if something doesn't seem to be clear, isn't making sense, you have permission to frown. And if that frown is not disagreement, but could you clarify that, I'd be happy to stop and do that, as long as I can see it. Dan... Dan asked me to review a little bit of my history. If you read the article, you've got more than I'll share here, but it'll at least give us a running start into the topic. I grew up in the Catholic Church, went to Catholic all-male high school. I went to Jesuit high school in Sacramento, California, as a matter of fact. Stopped going to church at age 17 when I graduated. And for a couple of years, if there was a tent meeting on the side of the road, I was there. Whatever girlfriend I had, that was the church I was going to. And through that 2 years, got to experience a variety of different Christian denominations primarily. My little foray into Buddhism didn't work very well. By age 20, I was brought into the church by a very dynamic group of young adults. Mormonism had a clear vision, a clear path, and I really needed that. And Mormonism was very helpful in bringing me to live more maturely, more responsibly. Served a mission a year later, served in institute leadership while I was in college at the University of South Florida, and then got recruited to teach institute up at the University of Florida. I then went full-time with church education, was institute director at Auburn University and the University of Georgia. have always read whatever is on the market, from the dangerous dialogue to the seductive sunstone. I was getting a little pressed by CES, feeling a little crowded, and I had the opportunity to go into the Air Force as an Air Force chaplain. I was doing a lot of interfaith things anyway, so it just made it kind of a natural transition for me. As an Air Force chaplain, you work in a general Christian environment, an interfaith environment. And as a result of that, I was able to see what I consider to be the best and worst in most religions, and I certainly experienced virtually every form of Christianity. I always felt Mormonism was superior due to the level of commitment and integration into people's lives. But over the years, I always struggled with the problem of what spiritual transformation meant and what it meant to be more like Christ. As I observed people and I began to admire people that I felt were Christ-like, I noticed an interesting thing. They didn't seem to be related to one particular religion, to any level of knowledge, or to any particular level of religious or spiritual commitment. And which I found a little bit perplexing, because I was looking for the way to get there, Christ-like. I did notice problems in other religions that I felt were barriers to spiritual growth and development. And then toward the end of my career as an Air Force chaplain, I was doing a tremendous amount of counseling with marriage counseling with Latter-day Saints. And as with others, I found that people just didn't seem to have the ability to make substantive, transforming changes in their lives, at least in this context of improving their relationships and marriages. Even motivated people who wanted to change just seemed to be trapped in unhealthy patterns of behavior. I finally realized I was one of those people. As much as I had done and experienced, when I had to shine the spotlight on myself, bad habits I wanted to get rid of, I didn't seem to be able to control. Being honest and vulnerable in relationships wasn't happening the way I wanted it. And my progress using the gospel, like most folks I was experiencing, tended to be minimal and not transformative. In 99, I injured my neck, back, and shoulder rather seriously. And for close to 2 years, experienced a lot of miserable physical symptoms. I'll leave it at that. Nothing helped. Medical community didn't help me. Fasting, praying, studying, reading more scriptures, offering up every animal in the neighborhood for blessings from above did not work. And out of desperation, I turned to meditation and meditative yoga. Both of these things were very effective in helping me to get control of my symptoms. And about 2 months into that, I realized that I'd stumbled on something I hadn't anticipated, that meditation wasn't primarily about stress reduction and relaxation. It was a carefully crafted spiritual path, and I was experiencing and enjoying spiritual insight and states of bliss that I had not before. This led me into a rather vigorous study of yogic literature and practice. And when I use the word yoga, I don't mean stretching. That's what Americans have done to yoga. Yoga means union with God. It's the quest for union with the divine. And so the word yoga is mean to, it refers to that actual union with God, or to the principles and practices that bring that about. You know, physical flexibility is just one small dimension of the whole system and philosophy of yoga. After I'd been in this path for about 3 years, I just suddenly became aware that I had changed. And of course, you ask your wife and you get an honest answer. And to my surprise, she said, "Wow, you're substantially different." And I said, "Well, you got to tell me about this." And that's what that first article is about. Essentially, what has happened is the negative traits, bad habits, and tendencies somehow had evaporated. And the Christ-like qualities that I desired and had tried unsuccessfully as a professional religious person through goal setting and praying and studying and keeping commandments and serving, failing in all of those areas, had just somehow naturally unfolded and were present functioning in my life. It was quite a mystery, I mean, I was mystified is actually the best word as to how that had happened. Don't you have to set a goal for something to work? Good things just happen on their own. Anyway, let's talk for a minute about mysteries and the mystical. Many definitions for mystery in the dictionary. These are some you're familiar with. Something that is difficult or impossible to understand or explain. Sometimes it refers to secret rites of pagan religions to which only initiates are admitted. There are Christian mystery cults also, obviously. The word mystic, a person who seeks by contemplation and self-surrender to obtain unity with or absorption into the divine or the absolute, or who believes in the spiritual apprehension of truths that are beyond the intellect. Well, you can tell that the words mystery and mystical are related linguistically as well as conceptually. And in my summary, a mystic is a person who seeks the direct experience of God, period. Not secondhand stuff, not stuff out of a book. First-hand, direct experience of the divine. And it's been my experience that one thing that the mystical path does is it takes the cosmic and makes it personal. It takes the cosmic and makes it personal. And that is the mystery. Now, the New Testament talks about the mystery of godliness. The Book of Mormon states that those who diligently seek the mysteries of God shall be unfolded unto them. Now, for LDS men, gosh, we think the mysteries are, you know, some secret document that's hidden in the vault of the First Presidency. You know, something that Brigham Young taught about Adam God, or something that was slipped out of the St. George Temple ceremony. The idea is that if we could just get our hands on that secret paper and read it, we would understand it. You know what I mean? And men sit around in these little study groups, you know, trying to figure out who heard this or who heard that, and did he really get in there? And did that's our whole idea of mysteries. Poor Dan Bachman, when he did his thesis, and I think it was late 70s, on plural marriage, and it was groundbreaking at the time. I was at a CES convention at BYU. And why three of us had to go to the bathroom at 12:30 in the morning, ask a urologist. But in any case, I caught Dan trying to come out of the bathroom. Bob Millett walked in behind me, and we weren't letting him out of there because we knew that he didn't put all of his research in that thesis. You know what I'm saying? We knew there were some mysteries about poor Mary, so we pushed him into the stall, and we didn't get out of there until 3:30. Now, LDS women, different story. The big mystery for them is why men under covenant still enjoy burping and scratching, and why football games seem to have a higher priority over marriage and children. I love women, and I mean that in the best sense. When you look at the story of the Annunciation in the New Testament, here an angel appears, right? An angel appears to let Zechariah and Elizabeth know that they're going to have a child, a miraculous child in her advanced years. The angel appears to Mary to let her know about the birth of this child without a father. And, you know, Zechariah, in typical male fashion, why don't you show me a sign? I mean, you can see him trying to get control of this and get his input in there. Of course, he got a sign, right? Oh, you want a sign? Let's be deaf. How about a pile of gold? I mean, that's the kind of sign you're looking for. What's fascinating to me is that Elizabeth and Mary, you think an angel appearing would be big enough of a sign, yeah. Elizabeth, Mary, it's like, yes, let's go with this. You know what I'm saying? I find women are that way. The mystical, they just kind of naturally flow with that, and we're trying to rationalize it, make sense of it, and get control of it, and put it on a piece of paper. In any case, in contrast to our Western notion that the human mind can understand all things, is the yogic view that birth into this mortal world results in a modification of consciousness that results in a narrow and limited point of view. How can a human mind that processes input from the severely limited senses of a mortal body trapped in space and time and three dimensions understand the infinite God? If a human mind could contain God, frankly, there would be no eternal existence. To the rational mind, a concrete theology is tempting since it gives the illusion of control, but rarely transformative. The keeping commandments, getting blessed formula works to a limited degree on the surface, but rarely at the core for a mighty change of heart. There was a wonderful book written in 1988 by a Protestant minister named Andrew Jukes. It's called The Names of God. This is a quote from that book. He says, "To creatures in our present state who only see things as they appear, the full truth or things as they are can only be taught by the union of apparent opposites." So why does Jesus torment the human mind by teaching in paradox? Well, we only have time for the simple ones, but you're familiar with the simple paradoxes. You find yourself by losing yourself. The greatest is the servant. Don't do your good deeds in public, but let your light shine so all men can see it. I mean, there's all kinds of contradictions within his teachings, much like a Zen koan. The whole idea is to take us beyond normal thought and consciousness to the mysteries, to the mystical, the place where spiritual transformation takes place. Mysteries are those things that are incomprehensible to the human mind. They are beyond conceptual understanding, but not experiential awareness. The mystics seek the mysteries through accessing higher states of consciousness, whereby they can have a direct experience of God, and thus the deeper reality. Words cannot describe it, because words are products of the mind. They can only point the way. The purpose of meditation is to disidentify one from the mind, thinking, and from the body, feelings, sensations, emotions. Thus detached, one is able to experience their essential nature as spirit. So in Mormon concept and in Mormon yogic lingo, what accounted for my natural but dramatic transformation was the time spent in a state of consciousness where my essential nature as spirit could commune directly with God, resulting in the nourishment and development of divine or Christ-like characteristics and qualities that were placed within by heavenly parents at my spirit birth. Does that make sense? No frowns. What accounted for my natural but dramatic transformation was the time spent in a state of consciousness where my essential nature as spirit could commune directly with God, resulting in the nourishment and development of divine or Christ-like qualities that were placed within by heavenly parents at spirit birth. I'm going to hit this from another angle. I was well on my way to following a yogic path and at least emotionally, mentally leaving Mormonism and Christianity. And I was telling our folks at the table, I just had this fascinating experience. I'm studying yogic literature on one hand, but I'm reading the New Testament all day to hospice patients. And then one day it dawned on me that the teachings and the message and the images in the life of Christ are so comprehensive, they literally encompass the core spiritual truths of every Western and Eastern tradition. And then I realized, wow, this Jesus is much more comprehensive than I had ever imagined. In the Bhagavad Gita and in the Upanishads, both of those books are classic yogic texts that were written hundreds of years before Christ. You find statements like these. Out of 1,000 who seek, one will find. Out of 1,000 who find, one will obtain. Hard to reach is the state of the illumined man. Only a few attain. Like the sharp edge of a razor, the sages say, is the path. Narrow it is and difficult to tread. Well, you're familiar with a similar statement by Jesus. Straight is the gate and narrow is the way, and few there be that find it. Well, most modern translations translate straight as narrow and narrow as difficult, as it should be. And once it's done, you realize that this saying of Jesus is a direct reflection of this statement in the Upanishads, that narrow is the way and difficult to tread. So, what is this narrow and difficult way? And why is it only a few people find it, according to these texts? And what was Jesus referring to? Was Jesus talking about a church organization? Or a mystical state of consciousness where we find the mystery of spiritual transformation? What is the baptism of water and the baptism of fire? When I pondered on the change that had taken place in me, a purging of the bondage of bad habits and conditioned reactive behavior, along with ungodly tendencies and desires, and the unfolding of an ability to make a broader range of choices in harmony with God, along with Christ-like qualities I desired, I sensed that what I had experienced was some degree of purification and sanctification. Now I say some degree because if I happen by chance to cut you off on the freeway, I don't want you to discount everything I'm saying. I realized that I had had a very tangible personal experience of the baptism of the Holy Ghost. Again, the idea that the mystical takes the cosmic and makes it personal. And this experience wasn't a change into becoming something different than what I was, but it was an unfolding of divine qualities already present. Now, I'm not talking about me, I'm talking about you, right? When I reasoned backwards and asked the question of what made this possible, it was clear that it was my immersion in a state of consciousness beyond thought, beyond identification with body and mind. Now, it's interesting that the symbol of water baptism is what? A grave. The death of the ungodly, the rebirth of the divine. In some Buddhist traditions is this notion that, meditation traditions, is this concept of what they call dying before you die. And the whole idea behind it is that you remove yourself so profoundly from your identification with body and mind that you experience yourself as eternal spirit, so when the time of your death comes, been there, done that. See, it's not traumatic, it's not painful, it's not something you're looking to avoid, been there, done that. And the idea is that this death takes place before then. In the yogic tradition is the notion of entering the breathless state. Well, what would a breathless state be? Well, no breath, no life, you're dead. And some of you are familiar with yogis over the years who've allowed themselves to be put in coffins and buried under the ground for lengthy periods of time, and they dig them up and, you know, they come back to life. But they go into the breathless state and survive in that very low metabolism. As a symbol of this whole process, that something dies and something is reborn. Is it possible that being born of water and spirit has to do with the mystical experience of putting your mind-body consciousness in the grave and experiencing the spiritual, eternal core of your being, which is then followed by the natural communion with God, which in and of itself is purifying and sanctifying? Does that make any sense? All right. All right. I'm sorry. Let's talk about Jesus for a minute. When I joined the church, the image of Jesus that was portrayed to me I don't want to lose folks behind here. What am I trying to say? We are commissioned to discover the mysteries. What are the mysteries? The mysteries are what unfold within you as you experience the mystical. The mystical is that which can only be discerned by the Spirit and not the rational human mind. Is that making any more sense? Okay. So, Jesus. When I first joined the church, the way he was presented to me was he's my elder brother. But he's a little more advanced. And he's going to help you. Lovely. Even though he's advanced, he still has to come to earth, suffer mortality, overcome temptations, and grow from grace to grace. Wow. I can relate to that Jesus, right? After I joined the church, I became acquainted with the Mormon doctrine Jesus. The one who has God status without having to experience mortality. The creator of numerous worlds. The God of the Old Testament. The one who had to be absolutely, completely perfect to be able to perform his mission of atonement. And a Jesus who was absolutely full of supernatural powers and could do literally anything. Well, that guy is hard to relate to. When he says, come follow me, you're walking on water there, brother. I don't know how I can do that. You see what I'm saying? That's a hard act to follow. How do you relate to that? A couple of weeks ago in my ward, we sang the song, I Am a Child of God, in both sacrament meeting and priesthood meeting. It dawned on me at that point that the preferred relationship for most Latter-day Saints with God and or Jesus is that of parent-child. We really like that image. And it's a logical image. He's perfect, all-knowing, all good. I'm ignorant, flawed. So I need him to lead me. Thank you. Frankly, I just never found that internally satisfying. There is a need for this parent-child relationship when we are spiritually immature, but is that it? Jesus also used other images for our relationship with the divine. Do you remember the image of a wedding feast? The image of a bride and a groom? I think this is more revealing of the kind of relationship that he really desires. I think we have a basic problem here, and that problem is we are so aware of our weaknesses and vulnerabilities, our fears and our foibles, that when we try to interact with God or Jesus in some way, we feel so different that we don't make a good connection with them. It's like they're other than, they are different than. And so they're kind of always out here, you know, and we hope they love us and bless us and forgive us and, you know, will show us the way. But that doesn't sound very intimate to me. Now, once I found myself through meditation and communion, and by finding myself, I mean discovering divine qualities already present within, something new began to develop in my relationship with the divine. Particularly with Jesus. I began to see similarities between myself and Jesus. Now, is that a shocking statement? That awareness of similarities was followed by attraction. What happens when similar things come together? There is a natural affinity and a natural attraction. And I don't know how to explain this in words, but it got to the point in my meditations when I contemplated Jesus, there was a feeling of infatuation. I mean, if you go read my meditation journal on the first day this happened, I was absolutely mystified that I could have feelings toward Jesus that were similar to feelings I had toward my wife when we first started dating. I mean, it seemed incomprehensible. But then these, you know, if you've read any of the Persian mystic poets, you know, God is the beloved, and they write things about, you know, I hope I haven't failed to kiss you a million times before I die. I mean, their image of relationship with God is couched in these romantic terms that are very difficult for us to relate to, particularly parent-child, right? You see your parents kiss? You know, that's gross. In any case, that attraction was followed by a profound intimacy that resulted in a new birth, the birth of a new understanding of Jesus and His work in atonement. He had really taken me as His bride. Now, there is a pregnancy in this whole thing, but your eyes are already spinning. I don't think I can get there. I can go there without somebody passing out. The point is, I felt like in my relationship with Him, I was no longer a child. My words cannot describe it. They can only point the way. His desire was to nurture the divine within me that I might be one with the Father as He is, made whole in love. Now those are Jesus' words in John 17. The reality behind those words is the mystery. Now, let's go into the garden with Adam and Eve and onto the cross with Jesus and see if this won't make more sense to you. Pray that it will make more sense to you. Alan has this visual over here on the wall. Oh, Alan, do I control this or do you? There you go.
I can do it.
Take us into the garden, my friend. I use the word spirit in this first block to indicate our original state in the presence of God. The yogis call this the unitive state. And the unitive state is portrayed very nicely in the Garden of Eden story, where everything is in harmony, everything is in balance, everything seems to be working together as one. It's blissful, it's harmonious. Well, we move from the unitive state, we partake of the fruit, and we're born into mortality, and we enter the world of duality. You're all familiar with duality, right? In, out, up, down, pleasure, pain, good, bad. That's the world in which we live. And something happens when we enter mortality and we enter duality. What happens? We become aware of our nakedness. Now, I taught a meditation seminar at Sunstone headquarters about a year and a half ago. Tom Kimball was in there. And I told him, next week we're going to talk about nakedness. And Tom jumped up and said, I knew there was a spiritual path for me. And I have to admit, at our next class he was wearing rather loose-fitting clothing. So, yes. What do I mean by nakedness? Well, the scriptures in many places refer to nakedness in a metaphorical concept, and I don't have time to quote the passages, but the point is, nakedness represents our weaknesses, our sins, our foibles, our flaws, our fears, our neediness, our vulnerability in our mortal, dualistic, body-mind identified state. That's where we are today. Now, what did Adam and Eve do when they suddenly discovered they were naked? Meaning what? Afraid, vulnerable, flawed, etc. What did they do? They did three things. They covered, they hid, and they blamed. Those were their three things. Well, that tells us a little bit about ourselves, doesn't it? We become aware, you know, you become aware of your nakedness, Your fears, weaknesses, vulnerabilities, what do? We cover, blame, and hide. Now, you know, how do we cover, blame, and hide today? Let's see, Alan, go for it. I'm going to use the word ego. That's the word that's used in yogic literature for this. We cover and hide behind an assortment of psychological defense mechanisms. Denial, projection, repression. Just get out your psychology 101 book. And when all else fails and we become exposed anyway, guess what? It's not my fault. It's my parents, my wife, my kids, whatever else. Some serpent's going to be to blame for this. Most of us fight voraciously to keep from being exposed, and this struggle for cover leads us to the development of an ego, a life story, a social mask that explains away our weaknesses and fears while accentuating particular strengths, associations, possessions, and sources of power and control. So, you see how we create our life story. Well, I went to this school, I have that job, I own this, I'm married to this. I mean, these are the things that we do. I'm a Florida Gator. We won football national championship and basketball this year. You know, we associate ourselves with things that have an appearance of stability and power to overcome that inner sense of nakedness. When these fail, we often distract ourselves by turning to sinful activities to compensate, manipulate, or to dominate. On either side of this equation, separateness and individuality is accentuated, and the spiritual ideal of unity is undermined. There are a few who intentionally expose themselves to shock others, knowing that most will turn away. It's a little device to get people to not look, right? Some craft a victim identity out of their nakedness in hopes that someone else will cover them. However, in most cases, our cover works fairly well, especially when it's honorable and respectable. Right? I'm a good person. I've had 100% home teaching for a whole year. Huh? I'm not naked. Yeah, the good guy covers the best. All right. Now, what's the problem with all of this? By the way, this is the theme in all spiritual traditions. Creation, fall, redemption. It's the story of the prodigal son. At home, into the pig pen, you know, back home. I mean, this is the big theme. In any case, here's where we are. From spirit into nakedness, into our ego to cover it up. And we live in this ego nakedness realm. That's the realm of the mind, the human mind. And the sad thing is, it's a false identity to cover a temporary experience that isn't really our true nature to start with. So, you know, the good news is, you're not really naked. By the way, you can use this diagram the way transactional analysis was used. Remember the parent, adult, child? You can do ego, nakedness, spirit, and see how people communicate to each other, ego to ego, right? Gators, let's bump chest. Women love nakedness to nakedness, right? They love to get together, expose something, talk about it, feel intimate. They love that naked to naked stuff. Guys keep trying to get in there, it doesn't work. But what we're really seeking for is what? The spirit to spirit. The true self relating to the true self of another. Anyway, we're in the garden. We understand the garden. Let's get on the cross and get out of here. What dawned on me was that these same images that we find in the Garden of Eden that describe our human predicament in mortality, in duality, is counteracted by the work of Jesus in his garden and on the cross. Jesus obviously did not live in the normal state of human ego and human nakedness. But his body became our ego. His body became our nakedness. And in the Garden of Eden, of course, ego is all about what? My way, right? I'm going to cover this nakedness my way. After a little resistance, Jesus completely surrenders to Heavenly Father. Not my will be done, but thy will be done. And then he takes that he takes really our ego, which has become his body, and the next day he allows it to be nailed to a cross, to literally be destroyed. Now, we don't like to think about this very much, but part of the shame, part of the horror of being crucified was being hung up in public naked. I mean, just when we think of the icons and the images of Jesus, you know, we always in our minds or in our paintings have to put some little cloth or towel or something over there, right? I mean, it just horrifies us. Why does it horrify us? Because we feel naked. And we're so used to covering our nakedness. Oh, Jesus, we've got to cover. But what is Jesus telling us? By allowing himself to be completely exposed like that. What's the message? Don't be afraid of this. Because the nakedness that you fear is not your ultimate identity. It's a temporary thing. Right? And so Jesus takes our ego and nakedness, crucifies it, exposes it for what it is, a temporary condition, and then at the end, what does he say? Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. He commends his spirit into his Father's hands. Well, this is the path we're supposed to be taking, crucifying the ego. See, to get from ego to spirit, where do you have to go? You have to pass through the nakedness. You've got to be willing to not be afraid to pass through that on your way to discovering your essential nature. And so, into thy hands we commend our spirits. Well, those are the hands of God. What does God do with those hands? Well, like the prodigal son who left home, we left home, ended up in the pig pen. We ended up in the pig pen, right? The mortality, the world. The prodigal son returns. The father comes rushing out to do what? First thing he does, clothes him in that robe. See, when we get from ego through nakedness to spirit, then those hands into whose hands we have commended our spirits clothe us in our true identity. And then, our true identity, as made in the image of God, every one of us. And then once we've been clothed in that true identity, what happens? There's a big party! So I say to you all, let's go to the party. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil, for that great walk through the garden, and hopefully we'll all be able to incorporate some more mystical items into our own life. We have about 7 minutes before the next set of sessions starts up.